This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. At the very beginning of this year, Governor Shumlin brought national attention to Vermont when he used his State of the State address to declare that opiate addiction was a full-blown crisis in this state. He said the first step in dealing with this problem is to acknowledge its existence.
We must bolster our current approach to addiction with more common sense. We must address it as a public health care crisis, providing treatment and support rather than simply doling out punishment, claiming victory, and moving on to the next conviction.
Shumlin called on the legislature to allocate $200,000 to immediately expand existing programs.
Right now, we have hundreds of Vermonters who are addicted and ready to accept help, but who are condemned to waiting because we don't have the capacity to treat the demand. That's the truth.
But almost a year later, there is still not capacity in the system to treat all those who want help. Across the state of Vermont, there are about 500 people on waiting lists to get into medication-assisted therapy programs. But advocates say the attention paid to the problem has brought more money, more focus, and more treatment options to Vermonters struggling with addiction. Today on Vermont Edition, we're going to take the hour to look at heroin and opiate addiction, where we've come from, what progress has been made, and what remains to be done to ensure that all Vermonters who want treatment have the ability to get it, that fewer people are becoming addicted in the first place, and that our criminal justice system reflects the values of our communities. If you have an experience with addiction to share, please post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Throughout the hour, we'll be hearing from Vermonters who have struggled to get treatment and get clean. Or if you have a question, you can also call 1-800-639-2211. That number again, 1-800-639-2211, or go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. Joining us first today is Governor Peter Shumlin. Governor, thank you very much for making the time.
Thanks for having me on.
It's been almost a year since that speech. Do you think we've made progress?
We've definitely made progress. I mean, this never was going to be an easy challenge to take on, and we've got a lot more work to do. But listen, this is what has changed since last January. We've opened up treatment centers across Vermont, and it's making a real difference. For example, we opened up a treatment center in Rutland. It's now serving 300 folks who are moving into recovery. The result is, if you talk to Chief Baker and Mayor Loris, that they've actually seen a huge decrease in the number of criminal of calls they get from folks who are at the police headquarters, who are, dealing with small crimes and or maybe larger crimes because folks are in treatment instead of out robbing people. But let's remember what the big challenge was last January. Number one, we had huge waiting lines for folks who needed treatment. So, I would argue this is the only disease in America where when you ask for treatment, you need treatment, we say, sorry, we can't help you. And by building out treatment centers, expanding treatment centers, we've made real progress there. Now, we still have waiting lines because as we've raised the awareness of the importance of moving to treatment and made clear that we have treatment available, we're now treating across Vermont over 2,500 individuals. We were treating 1,700 when I gave the speech a year ago. So obviously demand has gone up as we've raised awareness and as we've changed the way we're dealing with things. But listen, here's the most important point. In addition to trying to work our way through our waiting lines so that everybody who wants treatment can get it, we're not there yet, but we're making real progress, opening up treatment centers across the state. We're now working on one in Bennington. It's important to know that we've also really changing the way that we deal with this as a disease and not just a crime as we dealt with it in the past. And as you know, D.J. Donovan, the state attorney up in Chittenden County, pioneered a program that was much more logical than the old system. The old system would say, if you're addicted and you get busted and the blue lights are on and the lights are flashing and all the evidence suggests that that's the best chance that we've got to move you out of denial into treatment, The old system would wait 3 or 4 months while you wound your way through a court system. You come before a judge, many months later, you're back using, you're back abusing, and the moment of opportunity to move you from denial into treatment is gone. What we're doing instead, and this is pioneered in Chittenden County, but Dave Fencer in Addison County is leading a program there. It's now expanded in Rutland, Lamoille, Windham, and applying to and expanding to the other counties around the state, is we say, we bring a third-party assessor paid for by the state, and they say, listen, this is someone that we should be scared of, and if it is, we move them through the court process and into jail. If it's someone that needs treatment that we should feel needs empathy and help, instead we say, instead of going to jail, instead of going through the court process, instead of having a criminal record, you go into treatment, get the other wraparound service that we have for you, you'll never see a judge, you'll never see a court of law, we'll move you into recovery and back into a productive life. And that's been hugely successful. So first is expanding treatment, second is rapid intervention. We've been much more successful in other states about expanding overdose rescue kits. We literally had 74 kits used as of last October. That means that 74 lives were saved from people who were ODing on these terrible drugs. And we've distributed over 1,200 overdose rescue kits across the state through my Department of Health. So
it sounds like there is a lot of progress that you've made. But let me ask you, you know, while we have you for this limited time, you know, I mentioned that there are about 500 Vermonters who are on waiting lists who want treatment but can't get it. And you spoke in the State of the State about expanding capacity, and you certainly have. But 500 Vermonters who are saying, I need help, and they can't get it because of these waiting lists. That's a really difficult situation to put people in when we are saying, as a state, we want to pay more attention to this, and if you need treatment, we want to get it to you.
Sure. The only thing I'd point out is that the situation was much worse last January. I mean, think about it. We've added almost 1,000 people to the treatment rolls in Vermont, and we've got a 500-person waiting list. I mean, a year ago, we were treating 1,000 less patients, and we had hundreds in waiting lines, at least 500. So my point is, we're moving as quickly as we know how. I think it's a great partnership that we put together. We're expanding treatment as, you know, quickly. We're going to continue, despite the very difficult budget that we're about to approach, to make this a priority. And, you know, as I said a year ago, this isn't going to be solved in a day. But I think the biggest thing, Jane, that we've changed is attitudes. And there's just no doubt in my mind that the attitudes have changed about opiate addiction, about OxyContin addiction, heroin addiction, because we've all said as a state, this is a disease. Let's treat it as a disease. Let's stop the days where we say to law enforcement, this is your problem, go solve it for us, and we kind of turn our heads the other way to opiate addiction. So I think we've added it to the diseases that we treat in Vermont. We're lifting the stigma. It's our neighbors, it's our friends, it's people that we all know, our family. And
I just have one more minute with you, so I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to ask you, because you just mentioned you're facing a difficult budget situation, dealing with a $100 million plus deficit. Are you going to have to cut any of the treatment programs that you expanded?
No, when we, you know, make tough budget choices, we also prioritize, and that's really important. And we all know that we lose Vermont's quality of life if we continue to look the other way to opiate and heroin addiction, because it drives crime. It also costs us a ton of money. When we throw someone in jail who should be in treatment, it costs Vermonters $52,000 a year to lock them up in jail. Now, for $138 a week, we can put them in a great treatment program. It costs us $1,138 a week to put them in jail. It just is penny wise, pound foolish. And
so are you saying you guarantee none of the programs that you expanded, that $200,000 that you added, none of that is going to change, $200 million?
What I've said, Jane, is that this is continues to be a priority of my administration. It's critical to Vermont's quality of life, and we're going to continue to expend the money that we need to spend to ensure that we're putting folks who need treatment in treatment.
Governor Peter Sumlin, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We are looking at opiate addiction and taking stock of what's been accomplished in the realm of treatment, criminal justice, and prevention over the past year. If you have an experience you'd like to share, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post at vpr.net. Kim says, I have not seen progress, and it's one of the things that makes me question staying and raising my family in the area. Cyrus says, the problem is only getting worse. People People who want to get clean or struggle to stay clean get very little help. My kids find needles at the bus stop in the morning. VPR's coverage of this issue over the last year has included a project called Traces. Digital reporter Taylor Dobbs is here to tell us a little bit about the experience of reporting on this issue. Welcome, Taylor.
Hi, Jane.
Describe the Traces project for us.
So as we were reporting on this around the state, we were going to a lot of the locations where significant events happened. We went to Rutland to a hotel where someone passed away as a result of drug-related violence. And it struck us how unremarkable this place seemed. It was just a hotel. But we realized that for some families and for people who maybe knew the people involved, that landmark was significant in their life. And we wondered how much of that kind of exists below the surface, where you or I may go by a place that has no significance, but someone else might say, I lost a friend there, or whatever the case may be. So we wanted to give people a chance to tell their story of addiction. And part of it was these places and these things that remind them of whatever addiction did to their life or was to their life. And so we opened it up to submissions and let people feed in photos and stories about how addiction affected them. And we ended up getting a lot of powerful things that maybe I wouldn't have thought of as someone not in addiction as being a big, significant part of it.
You also were going to a lot of 12-step meetings and talking with people, and you met a young woman named Megan who you ended up doing a profile of. Why did you choose to do a story on her specifically?
Well, I think a lot of people who aren't part of this community feel like there's a stereotype of an addict, and you'll go into one of these meetings and everyone will be exactly what you'd expect to find in a meeting full of people who have struggled with addiction. And one of the people I ran into at one of these meetings was Megan, and she just had this very sort of bubbly personality and didn't fit the mold that I had sort of walked in with and that I knew wasn't real, but she really stuck out as someone who I could walk by on the street and I wouldn't think anything twice about. And so I wanted to show people in Vermont and our listeners that addiction is really everywhere and we don't necessarily see it, but there's people all over the state who are struggling every day to stay clean or to get help.
That's VPR's Taylor Dobbs telling us a little bit about the Traces project that VPR's digital team worked on this year. And we have a link to these pretty incredible stories at vpr.net. Taylor, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Taylor just mentioned Megan, who he got to know and talk with for the Traces project. And Megan joins us now on the phone. Hi, Megan. Thank you very much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you. I'm really excited.
Well, I'm excited to be able to say that from what you've told us in January, you will have been clean for 18 months. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yep, I will.
What did it take in the end to get clean and stay clean?
Oh, God. Let's see. I've heard it called the gift of desperation, which seems pretty accurate for me. I was just so sick of living the way that I was, that I was just really desperate to do whatever I could to get clean and to stay clean.
What's been the hardest thing for you over the last 18 months in terms of your recovery process?
I guess being vigilant, probably. You know, I've gone through phases in my recovery where I felt kind of, you know, I get a little confident about things. You know, I feel like I really have a handle on it, and I stop doing the things I really need to do to take care of myself, and then I kind of slip back into some old behaviors, and then I get scared, you know, that I'm going to relapse, and then I go back and I do the things that I need to again. So it's been kind of a battle with complacency and staying vigilant.
When you look at yourself and your addiction, do you think of yourself as a heroin addict, or does being an addict have something sort of more encompassing in terms of how you have to think about your behavior?
Oh, I am not a heroin addict. I am an everything addict. I am a more addict. That was something I was thinking while listening to Governor Shumlin is it's really not just heroin addiction. It's just addiction. You know, I think making the distinction can be really dangerous.
So when you think about recovery, do you find yourself replacing one addiction with another? And when it's not an addiction to something that some people would find dangerous, you know, is that, how do you deal with that?
Oh, God, yeah. For me, like, addiction is a disease, and drugs were a symptom. But I've, you know, when I got rid of drugs, I replaced that with so many other things. You know, it was relationships. It was attention. But, I mean, God, I've used so many things since I got clean. You know, it's pretty much whatever I could use outside of myself that would make me feel better or distract myself. I mean, I used scrapbooking projects for a while.
Yeah, which must sound, you know, sort of silly to some people who have never struggled with an addiction. Like,
oh,
how could
sure,
you be addicted to crafts? And
it
how do you?
Silly to me.
Well, yeah. I mean, so how do you approach trying to make sure that you are healthy in all of your behaviors when it's something like scrapbooking that obviously you're not going to get the same level of treatment for?
I have to really question my motivation behind things. You know, I have to look at this need I have to try to control the situation I'm in and my environment. You know, I really have to question everything. I have to look at, am I doing this because it's something I enjoy doing? It's something that brings me some kind of satisfaction or enjoyment? Or am I taking this overboard? Am I doing this because I don't want to think about something else? Or am I doing this because I think it's going to fill this hole that I think that I have inside me?
Megan, you work as a nurse. Since you're working in the healthcare field, do you find yourself looking at people and seeing signs of addiction or wanting to address addiction in some of the people that you work with?
Well, I work as a nurse's aide. I work with a lot of elderly people, and specifically with dementia. So I don't necessarily see it in patients I deal with, but I've definitely seen it in coworkers. It's funny because I'm generally pretty open about being in recovery. How many people approach me and then they want to talk about, you know, it was their mom or their dad or their sibling, or it's them and they don't know what to do. Or it's interesting. I remember thinking, like, God, I know all the drugs that all my friends have ever done.
Is there still a stigma for you in terms of getting work and keeping work? I mean, you mentioned you're open about your addiction, but is it difficult to work as a nurse's aide?
I've come across some different responses. You know, I've had some people who have been incredibly supportive, you know, and they want to look at key tags or medallions I get for clean time, and they get really excited. And then other people just kind of, they look at me weird, or they think maybe I'm exaggerating because I don't look like maybe I've done or gone through all the things that I have. Or some people just get really uncomfortable and they really don't want to talk about it. So I kind of have to gauge reactions, I guess, and share little details kind of slowly.
You said you were listening to Governor Shumlin talking about the state's response. What would you like to see the state do more of to support people who are going through addiction?
Well, I mean, part of it is I feel like when anyone mentions treatment, I feel like a lot of it is focused on drug replacement therapies. And that's definitely something that's been a part of my recovery that's helped, that I'm actually tapering off of now. But I needed more than that. You know, it helped the brain chemistry and the cravings, but I really needed more to learn how to change my behavior. And for me, I was thinking about this yesterday. You know, I felt like I really needed to be physically removed from the situation in order to even get a couple days together away from drugs. And I remember being at rehab for maybe 7 days, and my insurance company said there was no medical reason why I needed to stay, and they wanted to send me home. And I'm really blessed that I have a social worker in my family who is on the phone with my insurance company, you know, every day, like just trying to get me more time. You know, I told them on my insurance company on the phone that if they sent me home, they were setting me up to fail, and they would have to pay for a hospital stay when I overdosed, or that my death would be on their conscience, because that's what it was. It was life or death at that point. And I really wanted to stay, and I ended up getting cleared for 15 days and then going home. And I've met so many people who've had to deal with that, who wanted to stay at rehabs so badly, and they get sent home because they can't pay for it out of pocket. That's an exorbitant price for somebody who's an addict, you know? So I think that's really too bad. I think that the people who are asking for help, especially people who are going to stay at a rehab, which is not a vacation, especially around here, you know, that they should be able to. I mean, it's such a big, big part of my recovery, and it just seems like such an important piece that's kind of missing.
Well, Megan, I really appreciate your perspective on what else needs to be done and what you've been through. Thank you very much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Megan is just one of the many Vermonters working to put their lives back in order after addiction. We'll be hearing from more of them over the course of the hour as we spend today's show looking at addiction and recovery in Vermont. We're taking stock of how the state has approached the opiate problem over the past year. And if you have an experience that you would like to share about addiction, yours or someone's you love, or if you want to ask a question, you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today on the program, we're focusing on the state's efforts to curb opiate addiction, addiction to prescription narcotics and to heroin, a street drug that's gained popularity because it is often cheaper and easier to get than the prescription painkillers many people start on. We are hearing the stories of some Vermonters who have struggled with addiction, and if you'd like to tell us your story, go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. You can write your story right into our discussion page there. Or you can call 1-800-639-2211. Raina says, I'm 38 years old and a recovering opiate addict. I am featured in the documentary film The Hungry Heart. I had the overwhelming honor of being a keynote speaker at the Governor's Forum on Opiate Addiction at the State House this past July, and I've been traveling the country sharing my personal story and what I believe we need to do to inspire real change moving forward. No matter where I am, the story remains the same. People are suffering. They are saturated in shame, and they don't have the faintest idea what to do about any of it. This is a nationwide epidemic, and the entire country is looking to Vermont as a leader in combating this issue. People are sitting up and taking notice in an unprecedented way because addiction is leaking into unsuspecting lives and families, and all of a sudden this is becoming an issue that's no longer affecting other people. It's affecting all of us. And let's turn now to Barbara Simaglio. She's the Deputy Commissioner for Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs at the Vermont Department of Health. She joins us. Barbara Simaglio, nice to have you back on the program.
Glad to be back, Jane.
I just want to press on this issue we were talking about with Governor Shumlin at the top of the show. 500 people waiting for treatment who have said, I need help. How do we get that number down? Certainly, the more capacity you add, at least right now, the more people are coming in to fill it. And if we're asking people as a state to come forward and seek help and that they will get it, doesn't the state have a plan to make sure that anybody who needs help can get it?
Well, that's a question we struggle with every day, Jane. We are running as fast as we can to make sure our workforce and our programs are available to treat all the people who want to come in the door. But because of the rapid expansion, you know, we've certainly not been able to catch up completely. Our goal is to get to treatment on demand, but as the governor said, it's not going to happen overnight. The important thing to know is that all of our current hub providers do provide interim services for people who can't get into the full program right away. We also have a number of outpatient treatment programs around the state that can provide counseling services. So when people are waiting, they're waiting for the medication, but that doesn't mean that there are no other alternatives. We also have 11 recovery centers that are in each of the counties in Vermont that have open doors for people who want to find recovery. They host 12-step meetings and other workshops and support groups that people can avail themselves of. And we also have our cadre of physicians around the state who are working to treat people in their primary care or family medicine practices. So while the 500 who are waiting for the medication-assisted treatment in the hubs, that's a very important number that we watch every day, that isn't the only opportunity for treatment. The young lady before me mentioned the residential programs. We also have three residential programs around the state that are serving people with opiate dependence.
Three. You mentioned 11 recovery centers and three of those rehab centers. I mean, that's still not a lot.
Yeah, well, if I go back to, you know, even a few years ago, we started not too many years ago, we only had one recovery center. Now we have 11. So I think, you know, the community has responded with incredible passion and heart in terms of saying, what can we do? How do we get more services in place? So I think for the size of Vermont, we are going as quickly as we can. We also have to look at, as people come into treatment, you know, there's only so many people who can come in at a certain time because of the protocols that they have to go through. So, you know, there's a clinical management task to this too. So it is complicated, and it's very frustrating. It's extremely frustrating for people who are waiting to get in. And if anything, we want them to hear that we are doing everything we can as a state and as a community to meet the needs.
We asked people to share their stories with us, people who have struggled with addiction or who work with people who struggle with addiction. And I'm going to play a little bit of a story that we got from Wayne Miller, who's a peer support advocate in the Upper Valley. He actually works at the Recovery Center. One of the things that you were mentioning, Barbara Simaglio, he works at the Recovery Center in the Upper Valley. Here's Wayne.
What my addiction was primarily to prescription medications, opiates. A lot of the people that I work with are in medicated assisted treatment, which would be Suboxone and methadone. Majority, probably say like between 19 and 25 age range. Seeing a lot of young couples trying to seek treatment together, you know, trying to get clean or sober, however you'd want to word it, at the same time as somebody else, I think just adds a whole nother layer of challenges. So basically, I've seen, like, you know, one partner in the relationship will be doing better than the other, and then the other will start to slip because the other is still using or drinking. I share my experience with them. I share the day-to-day aspects of recovery that I feel like we don't really hear about enough, of like actually dealing with your problems. I know for my case that it really was the hardest thing. I'd always turn to drugs and alcohol for, you know, an escape of any negative emotion that I was feeling. And so once those were gone, I was on my own. You know, my main goal is to let people know, primarily people my age, I'm 27 right now, that living without drugs and alcohol is possible. I mean, before I started this path in recovery, I didn't think that it was possible. I mean, everybody around me used to some degree or another. I think the main thing that I'm seeing that really is loud is that there's waiting lists, and people are waiting to get into treatment, and whether that's counseling at any of the local agencies or the medicated assisted treatment at any of the hubs, that everybody's waiting, basically. And, you know, I feel like it's getting worse from when I was still actively using. But then, I could have been just oblivious to the realities of it. But it seems like it's getting worse, and I'm hoping that it's coming to a head, and that there's enough people that are talking about this and trying to combat this that, you know, we can get some real work done.
We also heard this from Hal Porter in St. Albans.
The biggest thing with the maintenance program is you know, I definitely understand using the medication or treatment to stabilize people in their addiction. I think where we're falling short is approaching people on what their plan is to get off from it. I think it's, I know when I was went on to the maintenance program, my primary care looked at me and said, you know, you can have it as long as you need it. Well, I'm an addict, an alcoholic, and when you tell me that in my head says forever, you know.
We also got this note from Emily who says, my brother is addicted to OxyContin and has been for several years. He's gotten to the point of even wanting to end his life. My brother is on the wait list and has been for a while. My family looks forward so much to him to reach the top of the list for treatment. In the meantime, he's been getting Suboxone via the black market. I suppose that's better than the injections he was doing. But most importantly, he's alive. Barbara Simaglio, we heard from several people there about treatments and waiting lists. I mean, just so much to grapple with in their stories. But what about the treatment, the medication-assisted therapy, Suboxone or methadone? Are those the best treatment options for people that we have?
The medication-assisted treatment with either methadone or buprenorphine are the evidence-based practices that are recommended. They are supported by research, and for people who, going through a clinical assessment, are shown to be appropriate for these treatments, they are definitely the best alternative. However, it isn't the medication alone, and several people alluded to that. Counseling is critically important. And through our Blueprint for Health, part of the Department of Vermont Health Access, we have a number of spoke physicians that are working with people and are providing counseling and support. So it is not just the medication. And then we also heard from people about the importance of the peer support, which goes on for a lifetime. You know, the whole idea of recovery is making new friends, building a new community where you learn how to live life in a different way. And so it is really a combination of all of those things. And medication is usually the entree into treatment and recovery. But as people stabilize, many decide that they want to go off the medication, and that's a decision they make with their physician and their counselor and are transitioned then off the medication as appropriate.
We're talking today about addiction treatment. We're talking about opiate addiction and recovery in the state of Vermont and looking at what kind of progress we've made in the last year since Governor Peter Shumlin made this a priority and made national headlines with Vermont's opiate problem. If you have a story you want to share or a question you'd like to ask, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post right into our discussion forum at vpr.net. When we come back, we're going to talk with somebody who treats addicts. We're going to talk a little bit about capacity, where the room is to build, and hear more stories. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We are looking at opiate addiction in the state and taking stock of the progress Vermont has made in dealing with addiction since the governor made it the focus of his State of the State address last January. And we're hearing from some Vermonters who have experience with addiction or work in the treatment realm. If you want to share your thoughts, go to vpr.net, click on Vermont Edition, and you can share your story there. Or you can call 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Frank in Cambridge. Hi, Frank. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. Good morning.
Hi.
In 2003, I returned home from the Army, and I soon after went to a funeral for a friend who committed suicide. He was an opiate addict, and one of my other good friends showed up at the funeral high. Right after that happened, we had an argument in downtown Montpelier that he needed to get his life cleaned up. He then got arrested for writing a bad check and got arrested. He then, you know, finally took the wake-up call seriously and got himself together. And he's now runs a successful business and it has two beautiful daughters. And, you know, it's nice to see that there is a positive light at the end of the tunnel if the individual is strong.
Frank, thank you very much for sharing the story of your friend. Appreciate that. It sounds like he went through the ringer, and it's nice to hear that he is having a healthy life and one that is happy and that you're still there for him. I appreciate your story. We're talking today with Barbara Simaglio. She's the Deputy Commissioner for Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs at the Department of Health. And let's bring Nels Kloster into the conversation now. He's an addiction psychiatrist with a private practice in Bennington. Dr. Kloster, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jane. Thank you.
You work with about 200 people on addiction issues. Are you able to keep up with the demand in the Brattleboro and Bennington area?
It's kind of tough. I mean, at the hub where I work in Brattleboro, we're able to keep up with the demand there, that primarily with methadone because the oversight, I guess the requirements a little bit different. Here in Bennington, I've started to work with two other doctors who've come and joined me as well, so that we're able to do a better job meeting the needs around here. But again, it feels like there's always more people calling and more people waiting to get into treatment.
Does it feel like we've made improvements to you, or do you just see that line, you know, stretching out and think, wow, it's at least in the realm of people who are getting addicted, we haven't made progress?
I think there's been a lot of progress. I think on the one hand, you know, calling attention to the problem, and I think like a lot of other callers have said that we're starting to see this as our problem, meaning it belongs to more of us, to our families and friends and ourselves, as opposed to some other group or somebody else's responsibility. So I do see an openness there that's helpful. I think too that we've made people more aware of treatment, and that helps as well when people realize there is some sort of alternative to what they're doing. They don't need to sort of struggle alone with their addiction.
Nels, just very quickly, do you see people relapsing, or is this something that once they do get help, they often are able to stay clean?
Well, Jane, it's sort of a cliche that you hear that relapse is a part of recovery.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not unexpected. Just like, you know, your diabetic might use some Mountain Dew, for example, that if people haven't made enough changes in their lives and haven't been vigilant, that they're going to find themselves vulnerable to either being in the wrong place, being with the wrong people, and to wind up having relapse. I think the key thing, though, is that they focus on sort of purpose in their life, social supports, and in that way, they remove themselves from those risks of relapsing. But it's very important because that's a moment of truth. That's a real learning opportunity. And if programs are determined to not have forgiveness for relapses, then you're really not going to do people much good in the long run.
Nels Kloster is an addiction psychiatrist with a private practice in Bennington. Dr. Kloster, thanks for just sharing a couple moments with us. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
And let's go to Sue in Brandon. Hi, Sue. You're on the line.
Good today.
Go right ahead. Yeah, hi, Sue.
Okay. I'm part of a group called Brandon Cares, which is a new organization that formed this summer in Brandon to support and educate and help with treatment for opiate addiction. And I just wanted to say, one of the things we feel really strongly about is that we do need to expand treatment locally in your community. And I'm hoping more groups like ours will pop up because I think having a primary care physician part of the spoke in that hub and spoke model is really crucial to dealing with this problem. And I think we need to streamline treatment. I think there are people still waiting for treatment.
Sue, I want to grab what you just mentioned there with the hub and spoke model and the need for more local treatment. I appreciate your point. Thank you very much for sharing it and put that to Barbara Simaglio, because that is one of the key pieces to the administration's way of dealing with this addiction crisis, this hub and spoke model. So there are these hubs where there might be intensive treatment and then spokes where you are getting treatment in your community. Where do you see that expansion happening so that throughout our state, we have the capacity for people to get treatment in their communities?
That is a critical part of the model, which is why it is a hub and a spoke. Neither one works unless you have both together. And all of the counties now have physicians prescribing and working with people with opiate addiction. But throughout the state, we really need more physicians to step up. We've heard Addison County, Brandon, you know, there are some places where we are struggling, and we've had a few new people step up. But I guess I'm putting out a plea that, you know, these are patients who are in the local practices just like all other patients, and we've tried to develop support and training for physicians. We have a learning collaborative that's managed through the Blueprint for Health, where doctors get information on best practice. They come together with their peers so they can share and learn from each other. So we are trying to support the physicians to take on a population that they may not have worked with in the past. But we continue to need more doctors. We have, at this point, 127 physicians that are prescribing and working with this population throughout the state. But we'd like to see that be a much bigger number.
That's Barbara Simaglio. She's the Deputy Commissioner for Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs at the Department of Health. Thank you very much for spending time with us today.
You're welcome, Jane.
We're looking at drug abuse, opiate addiction, and treatment on the program today. And finally, we'll hear from someone who has spent the last year dealing with the repercussions of opiate addiction. Producer Sage Van Wing spoke with another young woman named Megan. This Megan just passed her one-year clean mark in October.
Megan was first introduced to oxycodone in her junior year of high school by her boyfriend. At first, they used it together on the weekends.
And then once we broke up, I was more interested in it because I knew that it made me not feel anything. So I didn't want to deal with the hurt of the breakup, so I started using every day.
Megan is 27 years old now, and she spent much of the last 8 years addicted to opiates.
I had plans to go to college, and I didn't. I put them on hold. I said I was going to take a year off, and I still haven't gone to college.
Two attempts at rehab didn't take.
April 2012 to about October 2013, it was my lowest point. That's when I used more than ever. I had about a $500 a day habit.
Megan's mom gave her some money, but $500 a day is a lot of money.
I mean, I was working and my paycheck was gone, you know, 2 days after I got paid. So I started doing other things and getting in with the wrong people, giving people rides to go sell their things and all that stuff. And I eventually got in trouble for it.
In November, Megan was charged with a felony that she committed a year ago, on the very same day she decided to get sober. She's seen Governor Shumlin on the news talking about lighter sentences for drug-related offenses.
That's one thing I did ask my lawyer about with my legal issues. You know, could I write the governor? Could he help me? Because the only reason I did this was to support my habit.
What finally helped Megan get clean was the prescription drug methadone. She told her family doctor about her struggles with opiates.
And she actually had somebody come to the doctor's office and have a meeting with me, and that person was able to get me into the Chittenden clinics within 2 weeks, which was pretty astonishing because there was about a 15-month wait. And I don't know how, but I managed to skip 852 people.
Megan doesn't have much of a support network. She lives at home with her mother, who she says is an enabler. Her brother is also an addict. And she doesn't tell anyone in AA that she's on methadone.
Because a lot of people think about it negatively. They think that it's just a crutch. And I could definitely see how they think that, you know, going from one drug to another. But I don't plan on being on methadone for the rest of my life.
She has to stay on methadone for now, though, because she's pregnant. 5 months ago, Megan got a call from a nurse at the methadone clinic. Their routine screening for pregnancy had come back positive.
I was scared. The person that I'm with was really hesitant. And he was worried about how it would affect my sobriety and my state of mind. Yeah, I mean, yes, I was scared, but since becoming sober, I have grown up so incredibly much. I work full time. I pay my own bills, and that's something I never did before. So I really am, I'm not scared anymore.
2014 has been a difficult year for Megan. Her living situation is tenuous, her work environment is unhealthy, and she's worried that a felony conviction will make it difficult to find another job. She wants to go back to school, but she doesn't know if she'll be able to get student loans, again, because of that felony. Her partner and her mother were both dubious about the baby, although they've started to come around. But Megan is proud of how hard she's worked on her recovery.
So as long as I tell myself that I'm not going to use for today, every day for the rest of my life, I think I'll be okay.
For VPR News, I'm Sage Van Wing.
And that will do it for today. We've been hearing a lot of stories about treatment and recovery, and if you would like to share yours, you can go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. If you missed a part of today's show and would like to listen back, you'll find it there as well. Another part of the governor's plan to address the opiate problem in this state was to change the way we prosecute and punish addicts. The legislature passed a bill outlining a program that would allow judges and prosecutors discretion in sending some people to treatment instead of jail. That program is just about ready for operation, and we'll talk about it in 2 weeks on Tuesday, December 30th. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening today.